and welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medical Publishers. My name is Michiel Tend and I will summarize some of the most important presentations given at the virtual meeting of the American Academy of Neurology, AAN. This meeting took place between the 15th and 22nd of April 2021 and was delivered in a fully virtual format. Now, inevitably, COVID-19, as seen from a neurological standpoint, was a very important part of the meeting. In a special hot topic session, Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Walter Koroshetz provided an update on the neurological implications of COVID-19. Dr. Fauci is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and chief medical advisor to the US President. Dr. Koroshetz is director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. To Dr. Fauci, one of the most puzzling and unprecedented aspects of COVID-19 is the wide variation in response of patients. He suggested a couple of possible explanations, such as underlying pre-existing immunity or the density of ACE2 receptors in the nasopharynx and the lungs. Dr. Fauci also stressed that the pandemic has highlighted what he called very disturbing health disparities in the US. People of color have a higher rate of infection, but they also suffer more severe consequences as a result of having more comorbidities. He said the Biden administration has taken measures to improve access of minorities to vaccination. Can vaccinated people still transmit the virus? Due to the relatively low levels of virus in the nasopharynx of vaccinated people, Fauci deemed this unlikely. He said a study on college campuses will assess this question. If the answer is negative, vaccinated people will not have to worry about wearing a mask anymore. Asked about advances in treatment, Fauci said that monoclonal antibodies and convalescent plasma are most valuable in the early stages of infection. He added that dexamethasone is a lifesaver, effectively decreasing 28-day mortality. However, Fauci thinks the future belongs to targeted antiviral therapy to be administered when symptoms emerge, to prevent hospitalization. Dr. Koroshetz addressed safety issues of COVID-19 vaccines. He said, "The question of vaccines in different neurological conditions has been studied over the years. We don't have any real concerns about the COVID vaccine being any different." Koroshetz observed that COVID-19 does not appear neurotrophic, even though it infiltrates nasal mucosa. Whether the virus invades the brain is controversial. There are also many unanswered questions surrounding the chronic fatigue syndrome after infection, now officially known as post-acute sequelae of COVID syndrome, or PASC. Possible symptoms include fatigue, memory and attention problems, dysautonomia, postural orthostatic tachycardia, sleep disorder, and pain syndromes. Koroshetz observed that the percentage of COVID-19 patients who develop PASC may be below 10%, but still constitute huge numbers. The pandemic has led to widespread repercussions on the delivery of healthcare. A cross-sectional observational retrospective study found that COVID-19 has resulted in decreased stroke care worldwide. Data for this study was collected from no less than 457 stroke centers in 70 countries, covering 6 continents. The results were presented by Dr. Tan Ngoc Nguyen from Boston University of Medicine, USA. He reported that there were 11.5% fewer stroke admissions, close to 81,000, during the first pandemic peak from March to June 2020, when compared to the 4 preceding months, with over 91,000 admissions. Reduction rates varied widely. They were especially high in Africa, 30%, and North America, 19%, but less outspoken in Asia, 6.5%, and Oceania, 2%. COVID-19 hospitalizations per site correlated with declined rates in stroke admissions. There were similar drops in the rate of IVT attempts and IVT transfers, 13% and 12% respectively. According to Dr. Nguyen, stroke hospitalization volume recovered by 9.5% over the two later months, May-June, versus the two early months, March-April, of the pandemic. This recovery did not apply to IVT. A key symptom of COVID-19 is chemosensory dysfunction, with about 60% of patients experiencing alterations in smell or taste. In a cohort of 813 healthcare workers from Quebec, Canada, with a positive COVID-19 diagnosis, chemosensory dysfunction often persisted after COVID-19. Results were presented by Dr. Nicolas Bussière from the University of Quebec, Canada. He explained that subjects completed a questionnaire about 5 months after COVID-19 diagnosis, evaluating loss of smell and taste during the acute phase and at the time of filling in the questionnaire. A chemosensory dysfunction home test was used to objectify the symptoms. Results were reported on a scale from 0 to 10, with 0 no perception, 10 very strong perception. There were 813 respondents. Of 580 patients with a compromised sense of smell during the acute phase, 297, or 51%, had not regained olfactory functions at the time of testing. Assessed with the home tests, 134, or 17%, had persistent loss of smell. Of 527 patients who lost their sense of taste during the initial illness, 200, or 38%, had not regained this sense when answering the questionnaire. When evaluated with the home test, 73 subjects, 9%, had persistent loss of taste. In a single-center study, obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA, was common in patients with cognitive impairment. This was found in a population with cognitive impairment primarily attributable to an underlying neurodegenerative and/or vascular etiology. OSA was assessed with a home sleep apnea test, HSAT, which is an alternative to polysomnography. Also, patients completed various assessments and questionnaires related to sleep, cognition, and mood. 67 participants who contributed complete HSAT recordings were included for analysis. Just over half was diagnosed with OSA. About a third had moderate or severe OSA. Having OSA was significantly associated with a lower Montreal Cognitive Assessment score, with an odds ratio of 0.4. Severity of OSA was correlated with the degree of cognitive impairment and actigraphy-derived sleep variables. Lower total sleep time, greater sleep onset latency, lower sleep efficiency, and longer awakenings. Future research should examine the prevalence of OSA in larger cohorts and assess predictors in specific neurodegenerative and/or vascular etiologies for cognitive impairment. There were some reassuring data for women taking anti-seizure medication during pregnancy. Having a seizure during pregnancy may not only harm the mother, but possibly the baby as well. So seizure control is an important part of prenatal care. There are some newer medications for which the longer-term effects are still not fully known. This is what Dr. Kimford Miyador of Stanford University in Stanford, California, said. He presented the results of the prospective multi-center MONIAD study, where MONIAD stands for Maternal Outcomes and Neurodevelopmental Effects of Anti-Epileptic Drugs. The study found no developmental delays at the age of 3 in children born to women taking anti-seizure medication. The MONIAD study enrolled 275 women with epilepsy and 77 healthy women during pregnancy. The primary outcome for children at age 3 was a verbal index score calculated by averaging scores on a series of cognitive and developmental tests that measured skills like vocabulary, listening comprehension, number recall, and pattern recognition. At enrollment, most of the pregnant women with epilepsy used lamotrigine, levetiracetam, or both. There were 275 children of women with epilepsy. They had the same verbal index scores as the 77 children of healthy women. In addition, there were no developmental differences between children of women with epilepsy and healthy women that could be linked to the different levels of anti-seizure medications in mothers' blood samples during the third trimester. The genetic basis of the broad heterogeneity that we see in the clinical spectrum of MS is still largely unknown. Italian researchers performed the first genome-wide association study, GWAS, that targets disease activity in MS. What they found was involvement of mast cells and neutrophils in the disease activity of relapsing remitting MS patients. A total of 790 patients were followed for 2 years from the moment they started a first-line disease-modifying treatment. Disease activity was assessed according to no evidence or evidence of disease activity 3, NIDA/EDA3 status. Close to 608,000 single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs, were subjected to the GWAS. Two SNPs passed the threshold for genome-wide significance. They were found to protect EDA status at 2 years. For three other SNPs, also located at chromosome 14, an association was found that suggested protection from disease activity, safeguarding NIDA status. There is possible involvement of two pathways here, called chymase 1 or CMA1 and cathepsin G, CTSG. These pathways are involved in the activity and degranulation of mast cells and neutrophils, respectively. Neutrophils and mast cells have been associated with disease mechanisms in MS, such as regulation of the blood-brain barrier, inflammatory response, and evoking a CNS-directed immune response. If confirmed, these results may provide important knowledge on mechanisms underlying disease activity and could lead to future therapeutic developments. Thank you for listening. I'm Michiel Tent on behalf of Medicom Medical Publishers. Stay healthy.